Thanks, David. And let me thank Christiane for the invitation. It's an honor to be here. It's a pleasure to be here to give a talk in honor of Eric Sawyer. I was a postdoc under Eric many more years ago than I care to think about now. And I still remember, well, I remember many things, not the mathematics we talked about, but one of the things I really remember is, he's not here yet. I guess. That would be, that was good, huh? Well, I thought maybe he was going to be in the back of the room. Okay, he's just a life alone. Okay. Well, what? I could talk about my fishing trip recently. So let me say that it's a pleasure to be here to honor Eric. He was my postdoctoral supervisor back in the day, and I still remember one thing that he said to me, which was that you know, it's okay to work on little problems. That's fun, and it's okay to do that now and then. But once in a while, if you want to be a real mathematician, you should try working on big problems. And that's still some of the best advice I ever had. I think it's a good idea. Glad to have had that advice. Glad to have had the experience of being a postdoc with Eric. Okay, so the stuff I'm going to talk about today is continuation of the things that Chemo was talking about. So once again, the starting point is this classical theorem of F and M Ries, who showed that for a simply connected domain in the plane, that the boundary is rectifiable implies that harmonic measure, which for me will always be denoted with an omega, is absolutely continuous with respect to the arc length measure. And for me, sigma will denote, well, in higher dimensions, that'll be the surface measure, meaning if we have a domain omega in Rn plus 1 with boundary omega that's n-dimensional, then sigma is going to be Hn measure, Hausdorff Hn measure restricted to boundary omega. Okay? All right, so the F and M Ries theorem was this, that for a simply connected domain in the plane, boundary omega is rectifiable implies that harmonic measure is absolutely continuous with respect to surface measure. As Chema mentioned, there was a quantitative version of this due to Lavrentiev. This is classical. It goes all the way back to 1916. Even Lavrentiev's theorem was 1936, I think. There's a more recent result of Bishop and Jones around 1990. Same hypothesis, simply connected, same background hypothesis, simply connected domain in the plane. They prove, first of all, a local version of the F and M Ries theorem, meaning what? Meaning that if you have rectifiability of merely some subset of the boundary, okay, then you have some subset that has positive arc length measure, okay? Then on that subset you have this absolute continuity. Omega on that rectifiable subset is absolutely continuous with respect to arc length measure. Okay? All right, so as Chema mentioned, what we are after is a higher dimensional scale invariant version of these results. And in fact, with a converse. So the philosophy, the rough philosophy is that you have rectifiability equivalent, in fact, to absolute continuity. Well, okay, that's not right. In fact, the Bishop Jones paper, they give a counterexample that shows that you need something extra, like some kind of topology. Okay, for these guys, the topology was simple connectivity. All right, but nonetheless, in the presence of some topology that's at least going to be true, and for us, it's going to be true. Well, I actually don't know if it's true even with topology in general and higher dimensions. But a scale invariant version of it is true. Okay? And the scale invariant version is that the boundary of omega is uniformly rectifiable, which Chema defined in his talk, so I won't do that again. We'll come back to that. If and only if harmonic measure is in weak A infinity with respect to the surface measure. Once again, weak A infinity just means that that if you have a Borel subset of a surface ball, then you have some estimate like this. True A infinity condition, you would not have the doubled ball here. So another way to look at it is A infinity is weak A infinity plus the doubling property, okay, which may be lacking here. Okay. I might add that there's a paper of Eric in which he studies these kind of weights and shows that many things that are true for the A infinity class are still true for the weak A infinity class. And they arise often naturally in PD context, right, where you have to double the ball on the right-hand side. In particular, Eric observed that this condition is equivalent to a weak reverse Helder condition. It's like the usual reverse Helder, but where, again, you have to double the ball on the right-hand side. Okay? So, again, this is not quite true. We need some topology in order to prove it, but for us, the topology is a scale invariant topology. Yes. Okay. Then let's move over here. Okay. So for us, topology is the one-sided NTA condition that Chema also mentioned, which I'll remind you again, means that you have interior, but not necessarily exterior corkscrews at all scales, and interior harnack chains. Okay? That's in contrast to the classical Jerson-Koenig NTA condition, which was sort of one and a half sided. It had, they required both interior and exterior corkscrews and interior harnack chains. Okay? The exterior corkscrews do a lot for you. They allow you to establish Heller continuity at the boundary for solutions which vanish on a portion of the boundary. And from that, you get all kinds of things like comparison principle and the doubling property of harmonic measure and so on. Okay? It also does quite another important thing for you, which I'll come to in just a moment. All right. Let me mention that there's a simple example of a domain that has only interior corkscrews and harnack chains, and that is the following. If you let omega be the complex plane minus F, where F is the Garnett four corners Cantor set. Okay, then this domain is one-sided NTA, and it also has an ADR boundary. So the boundary of omega in this case is just the four corners Cantor set. That's ADR. Of course, it's known that that F is not rectifiable. Okay, and in fact, there is no exterior domain because omega here is everything that's not F. Okay, so this is an example of a domain that's one-sided NTA, but the boundary is not uniformly rectifiable, and that is relevant. Okay, that is relevant for the following reason: that if you have full NTA of Jerison-Koenig, meaning that you also have an exterior corkscrew in addition to this, then by the work of David and Jerison, the boundary of omega is uniformly rectifiable. In fact, it has big pieces, using the notation from Shema's talk, has interior big pieces of Lipschitz subdomains. Okay? All right? Which is a stronger thing than uniform rectifiability. All right? So, full NTA just by itself, the exterior corkscrews give a lot of powerful information, including geometric information. Okay? You get rectifiability properties just from that. Okay? But this shows that in the absence of exterior corkscrews, uniform rectifiability has to be imposed. Okay? It doesn't come for free. All right? Okay. So, all right. So let me make a let me say something about a little more about this David-Jerison result. Again, I apologize if I'm repeating a little bit of what Shema told you, but I think it's important to set a little bit of context here. Okay. So the David-Jerison result implies, in particular, that omega. Okay, so for full NTA, and by full NTA I mean in the Jerison-Koenig sense. I mean two-sided corkscrews and interior Harnack chains. Okay, this implies that omega is actually a infinity with respect to sigma. How do you get that? Well, it's because of this interior big pieces property. So the interior big pieces property plus the maximum principle plus Dahlberg implies this estimate that's going to be fundamental for us, so I'm going to mark it with a star. And that is that if you take omega with corkscrew point with respect to some surface ball delta, then this is going to be, okay, there exists some uniform eta positive, such that this will be bigger than eta whenever E is a subset of delta such that sigma of E is bigger than or equal to 1 minus eta sigma of delta. Okay? So some kind of non-degeneracy condition for the harmonic measure. Okay? And again, you can see that by this picture. Here's your surface ball. Right? It's the intersection of a Euclidean ball with a boundary. You've got some Lipschitz subdomain that has an ample contact with the original boundary. Okay? You invoke Dahlberg's result in the Lipschitz domain. You actually have that harmonic measure in the Lipschitz domain is A infinity with respect to surface measure. And so then if this constant eta is chosen small enough, then your set E still has an ample intersection with the boundary of the Lipschitz subdomain. Okay? And now you invoke the A infinity property, and then you use the maximum principle, which is why you need this containment. You need interior big pieces. Okay? And then you get this. All right? Okay. So also, as Chema mentioned, there's this result of Benowitz and Lewis, where they take this conclusion as a starting point. Okay? So again, they get this estimate star for free. Now, in the presence of the NTA condition with Harnack chains, when you have comparison principle and all that, then star self-improves to A infinity with the comparison principle. Okay? So David and Jerison got it, just got. This condition star self-improves to A infinity by the comparison principle. Now, for Benowitz and Lewis, comparison principle wasn't available, okay, because they're not taking NTA as a starting point, they're just taking this as a starting point. Nonetheless, they were able to show that basically star always self-improves to a weak A infinity. Okay? Even in the absence of comparison principle. All right? Now for us, the whole point, the deep fact, kind of the main point of what we're doing, the main point is to establish star, okay? Because once you've got this, all right, then you just invoke the Benowitz-Lewis machine and you get weak infinity, okay? And so the theorem, the result that I'm going to talk about today, this joint result with Chema, is that for one-sided NTA, the boundary omega is uniformly rectifiable, implies that omega is weak infinity with respect to sigma. Okay? In some scale invariant way, I'll say a little bit more about that in a moment. Okay? Chema, of course, in fact, the converse is also true. Chema discussed the proof of the converse. So I'm going to discuss the proof of this direction. Okay? Also, as a corollary of that, I won't bother to write this down, but as a corollary of this, it turns out that you only really need to have one-sided NTA holding in some kind of interior big pieces sense. Because then again, okay, if you have an interior big pieces of a thing that's good, then your original domain is still good against this maximum principle argument. Okay, where in lieu of Dahlberg, you're using this result. Okay, it's a little more complicated than that because you don't quite have fully infinity, you only have weak infinity, so that's a little more delicate, but it still works. Okay. Okay, so again, for us, the main point is to prove I can we breed above that line? Okay, that's my lower bound. All right, so for us, the main point is to prove then, without any extra assumptions on the boundary beyond uniform rectifiability, which you have to have, okay? So no interior big pieces thing, and without assumptions on the exterior. Okay? So no exterior corkscrews. Okay? All right. So how are we going to do that? Well, there's an initial step where you work in approximating domains. As Chema mentioned, we work in approximating domains in both directions of the result. The advantage of the approximating domains is that they enjoy the Wiener test. Every boundary point is regular in the sense of Wiener. And you have exterior corkscrews at least small scales, okay, although with no quantitative control. But nonetheless, for the approximating domains, you still get a quantitative comparison principle. This is kind of amusing that the approximating domains enjoy the comparison principle with quantitative bounds that do not depend on the parameters of the approximating domains. They only depend on the original parameters, right? The original one-sided NTA hypotheses and the all forces of even uniformly rectifiable constants, okay? Actually, not even the rectifiable constants, just the ADR and one-sided NTA conditions, all right? Again, we don't know how to pass it to the limit, and probably, I'm guessing maybe it doesn't pass the limit because our boundaries need not be regular in the sense of Wiener, okay? You can still define harmonic measure in the sense of Perron, but you don't have continuity of solutions to the boundary, okay? All right. But on the other hand, what that means is that for the approximating domains, once you've established star uniformly, not depending on the parameter n that indexes the approximating domains. Once you've established star for the approximating domains, it does self-improve, okay? You use the comparison principle, it self-improves to A infinity. So for the approximating domains, you actually get A infinity. You have doubling, okay? And then you establish star for the approximating domains with uniform constants. And then you can pass to the limiting domain use the maximum principle again, somehow, to pass the estimate star, but not the A infinity property, to the original domain, okay, with preservation of the constants, okay? And then you invoke the result of Benowitz-Lewis, okay? So the whole crux of the matter really boils down to establishing star for the approximating domains. So in the approximating domains, we get to assume these extra nice qualitative properties, okay, like the Wiener test. All right. But still, the whole ball game is to establish this estimate star in a uniform way. Okay. Although, on the other hand, it will be nice that we actually are going to have the self-improvement, because it's in the nature of our approach that we need to be able to make self-improvements. We need to actually to be able to work with A infinity during the course of the arguments and not just this, okay? And that's an artifact of the method. which is based on a technique really developed, well, really to some extent by John Lewis, although I'll qualify that in a moment, which John calls the extrapolation technique. Extrapolation of Carlson measures. So what's the rough idea of this? The rough idea is that you use a corona stopping time construction as in the work of Carlson and Garnett, plus an induction or bootstrapping scheme to reduce matters to the case where you're working in sawtooth regions where some controlling Carlson measure is small. Okay? So there's going to be some Carlson measure that controls what's going on. For us, I'll make this more precise in a moment, but for us, the hypothesis is a uniform rectifiability. As Chema mentioned, uniform rectifiability is characterized by various kinds of Carlson measure conditions. We're going to pick one that's especially convenient for us. And we're going to be able to, eventually, using this machinery, work in sawtooth regions where that controlling Carlson measure is small. And then it turns out that it's enough to show the thing that you want, which for us is some kind of A infinity property, but only in the sawtooth. Okay? So let me make this all precise. Okay, so how do we turn this into reality? Okay, so for us, first of all, the boundary of omega, because we assume this all-fours David property, it's a space of homogeneous type, therefore it has a dyadic cube structure. Okay, it's the usual homogeneous space dyadic cube structure constructed by Michael Crist. Although, actually, there was a predecessor of this due to Guy David in the special case where we have all fours David regularity. Okay? So, for us, a discrete sawtooth is the following sort of object. You're going to be given some Q that's a dyadic cube. Okay? And that's in quotation marks. It's not a true cube. It has these properties of a dyadic grid. Okay? So you have this dyadic cube and a family F of non-overlapping dyadic subcubes of Q. Let's call them QJ. Okay? Then the dyadic or discretized sawtooth with respect of Q, with respect to that family, is the collection of all Q primes. And again, all my cubes are always the dyadic ones. The Q primes that are contained in Q such that Q prime is not contained in any QJ and F. So these QJs are forming a maximal family. Okay? And then we're also going to define a geometric sawtooth which is with respect to the same family in Q. Okay? It's called omega sub FQ. And that's going to be the union over the Q primes in the discrete sawtooth of some regions that I'll call U sub Q, which are These are sort of Whitney regions relative, I should say Q prime, because I'm thinking union over the Q prime. These are Whitney regions with respect to the Q prime. Okay? There's a way to cook these up in such a way that, in particular, the Harnack chain property is preserved in these sawtooths. Okay? You can do that so that these inherit the Harnack chain property from the original domain. All right? Okay. And now, what we want to work with, okay, so let's recall, as Chema mentioned, there's this result of David and Sams, which says that, in our context, Bonjour Omega is uniformly rectifiable if and only if the following thing, grad squared S of 1 of x squared delta of x denotes the distance to the boundary, if and only if this thing, which I'll call d mu of x, is a Carlson measure. And remember, S is the single layer potential for Laplace's equation. Okay? And that's the Carlson measure we're going to work with, or really a discretized version of it. Okay? So you can associate this Carlson measure to some discretized one that's amenable to doing stopping time analysis down with the microcristatic cubes on the boundary. Okay? All right. And now what we need to show is that there exists some epsilon naught such that if let me say it this way. Some appropriate tent region relative to Q enjoys a sufficiently small Carlson arm. Actually, I should say it like this. Okay? All right. Such that if the Carlson norm is sufficiently small, but they're not the tent regions. They're the sawtooth regions. Sorry. Okay? They're the sawtooth regions. So if the Carlson norm with respect to the sawtooth is sufficiently small, okay, then a certain projection of the harmonic measure with pole at the corkscrew point relative to Q is in dyadic A infinity with respect to sigma on the cube Q. Now, dyadic A infinity just means it's like usual A infinity, except you're just working with dyadic cubes. The projection thing just means this. This is a measure. What is d of p f of omega? It's just d omega on the complements of the QJs. And on a given QJ, it's just the average. Okay? All right. Okay, so suppose we can do that. All right? Suppose we can do that. Then it turns out that then Chema and I have a version of the Lewis extrapolation machine that lets us draw the desired conclusion. That lets us conclude conclude that omega with pull at the corkscrew point is actually in A infinity with respect to sigma, again on the QQ. Okay? All right. All right, so I won't get into the details of the extrapolation machine. Again, as I say, it's some kind of corona construction. But let me just say a little bit about how we get to this point, how we get to show, how we're able to show that smallness of the Carlson norm in a sawtooth implies the dyadic infinity property for the projection relative to the sawtooth of the harmonic measure. Okay? Let's give this a name. Okay, so that's what I'll do in these last 15 minutes or so. Okay, so the first step is to observe that that Harnack chains enable you to prove a certain Poincaré inequality. That's probably not too surprising. Okay? If you think about how you prove Poincaré inequalities. Because Harnack chains, as Gentleman mentioned, is really just a scale invariant version of path connectedness. Okay? All right, now with Poincaré, now what does that do for you? Poincaré lets you say that is going to let us say that that d mu, or its discretized version being small on a sawtooth, implies that the gradient of S of 1 minus an appropriate constant vector is small in some LP space on the sawtooth. Okay? And that's not surprising either, because that's the kind of thing that Poincaré does for you. Here we have one gradient, here we have two. Okay? All right, then this last thing, in turn, it's not hard to show. We'll see if I have time to discuss this in any more detail, but for now, let me just say what it does for you. It actually does for you something very nice. The smallness of this thing in some LP lets you show that the sawtooth has exterior corkscrew points. Okay? And all the scales up to the scale of the diameter of Q. Okay? All right. And that's really the heart of the matter. Okay? Okay, because once you've got exterior corkscrews, of course, remember that the sawtooth inherited the interior properties from the original domain. So therefore, the sawtooth is now full NTA in the sense of Jerison and Koenig, and therefore, by the V Jerison, has the interior big pieces of Lipschitz subdomains condition, and therefore, we have that that harmonic measure for the sawtooth domain is A infinity with respect to surface measure for the boundary of the sawtooth. Okay? And now at this point then, we establish a sort of dyadic version of the Dahlberg-Jerison-Koenig sawtooth lemma, which allows us to pass from harmonic measure for the sawtooth to the projection of the original harmonic measure. Okay? Okay, and that's what we wanted. Okay, and then we're done. All right? Okay. So maybe, since I have a few minutes left, maybe I should just take the time to say a little bit about why smallness here, this is not hard, but it's probably the only thing here that isn't sort of intuitively clear. Why smallness of this thing for an appropriate constant gives you exterior corkscrews. Oh, I realize here I didn't draw my lower bound.
At that point, I figured you were in court.
Okay. Well, I was just giving a rough idea there. Okay. All right, so what's the idea here? So things are scale invariant. So let's take R to be 1, okay? So I'm working on some surface ball of radius 1. Okay, that means the intersection of a Euclidean ball of radius 1 with a boundary, okay? All right, and let's, okay, so B is a ball of radius 1 with center on the boundary, and I'm going to take phi to be a smooth cutoff supported in the ball, which is non-negative and identically 1 on half the ball, okay, with bounded gradients, okay? All right. Okay, and now the ADR property, Dolfer's David regularity property, says that you have a uniform bound from below then of the integral on the boundary of phi times d sigma. Okay? But now, since S, remember, is the single layer potential, the kernel of S is the fundamental solution for the Laplacian. So, so we have this, right? This is a weak formulation of applying the minus the Laplacian to this guy, okay? All right, but that's the same if we subtract any constant vector from here. That's going to be the same, right? Because this is a gradient, it won't see the constant. Okay, now at this point we're going to split, this is actually absolutely convergent integral here. We're going to split this into two pieces. It'll be omega f q intersected with the ball of that integrand plus the complement. Okay, the exterior domain for that sawtooth. Okay? All right. Well, this is small, right? Because that's what we're doing. This is small in some LP sense. Okay? So we hide it. We hide it back here. Okay? Here, now you just use Hilder's inequality. Okay? So this is less than or equal to the volume, n plus one-dimensional volume measure of the ball intersected with this exterior domain. to some power. One over P prime, and then you've got an LP estimate. In the ball for grad S1 minus C. And that's just, we don't worry about smallness anymore, but it's still just bounded. It's just going to be some uniform bounds. Okay? So if you combine that with this lower bound, what you obtain is a lower bound for the volume of the portion of the ball in the exterior domain. Okay? So we get that B intersected with the exterior domain as volume bounded from below. And now, since the boundary is all fours David, and in particular the sawtooths inherit the all fours David property from the original boundary, okay, it's just a simple pigeonholing argument to see that all fours David plus this lower bound for the volume implies that there's a corkscrew point in here, okay? And that's your exterior corkscrew. Corkscrew, if I can spell corkscrew. Okay, and that's what we wanted. All right, so I think this is a good place to stop. Thanks again.